We've been doing a series on the history of the RPCNA. This is week number 5 of 8-week series. And I'll just do a real quick review where we've been. As you recall, with all Presbyterian churches, you kind of have to start with Scotland because Scotland is sort of where Presbyterianism started. So we started there and we saw how the Protestant Reformation of Martin Luther and John Calvin came to Scotland with people like Patrick Hamilton, George Wishart, and John Knox and things like that. And we saw how that happened. We saw that when that happened in about 1560 to 1567. And we saw the struggle between prelacy and Presbyterianism that occurred between King James and the Scottish Church. And you remember Andrew Melville and his the two kings in Scotland quote when he was in front of King James. We looked at the when King James dies, his son Charles becomes king as more forceful. And that results in kind of this revolt and eventually the Second Reformation of Scotland. That the National Covenant comes out of that, and then the Solemn League and Covenant between all of Great Britain. We followed all that. We saw how Charles II is actually executed by the English Parliament, and then Oliver Cromwell for a time reigns as Lord Protector. When he dies, the King Charles II, the son of the executed king, is restored to the throne in the Restoration in about 1660. Then we saw how he immediately outlaws Presbyterianism in Scotland, makes it Episcopalianism. And then with that big dissenting group of ministers and covenanters that refused to be a part of the official church, we remember he attacked them with indulgences, which brought many of the ministers back in to the Church of Scotland, leaving the covenanters with no ministers. And then he also attacked them with persecution that became more and more severe, culminating in the killing times. And we looked in detail at that time, the killing times, last week, and studied some of the stories and saw how brutal it was. And then in 1688, Charles has died. His brother James is now king and even a worse persecutor than his brother. But he's Roman Catholic, and all of Great Britain does not want to go back to Catholicism. They're okay with Episcopalianism, but they don't want to go back to Roman Catholicism. And so they sort of revolt against him. And his sister, Mary, who's married William of Orange from the Netherlands, they come together, William and Mary, from the Netherlands, and sort of take the throne from James. He kind of gives up without a fight, and so we call that the Bloodless Revolution, because there was no blood spilt over that. And so William and Mary become king and queen then, and they're not Roman Catholic, and they're more Protestant, and they're okay leaving people as is, and so they don't persecute, and the persecution really stops in 1688. So that's where we had left off last week. And this week we want to sort of continue on from there, and then we'll look at the church in Scotland, the RP church in Scotland up to the present day, and then look at the church in Northern Ireland, the RP church there up to the present day, and then we'll touch on how the RPs came to America and actually get to the RPCNA, which is North America. We've been focusing on the first three letters. But so moving forward, and we talked a lot about the killing times and the persecution last week, and it was interesting to me. Have you heard of Daniel Defoe? Do you know him? He's a famous author, wrote Robinson Crusoe, if you've heard that book. He was living during this time, and he was pretty sympathetic to the Covenanters. He went to a conventicle, one of these 7,000-person conventicles. He went there and kind of witnessed it. And so he really felt like the Covenanters were in the right and that it was wrong to persecute him. And he actually comparing that time of persecution to other times, he said that the killing times of the Covenanters was worse than the Roman Emperor's persecution of the early church and worse than the Roman Catholic Inquisition. So in his estimation, it was that severe. That's his opinion, but it just reminds you how severe it was. So moving on then to the Revolution settlement in 1688, this is when William and Mary come to the throne. And all this time, you got to remember that, the Covenanters are all about making all of Great Britain Presbyterian, right? That was what the Solemn League and Covenant was all about. That was what they wanted. They weren't compromising. They wanted everybody, everything in the nation to be Presbyterian. On the other side, you had King Charles and then King James, who wanted everybody to be like them, Episcopalian or Roman Catholic. And so that was the issue. That was the controversy. And now comes this guy, William of Orange. He's a new king. And he looks around. And he says, well, England, you want to be Episcopalian? Go be Episcopalian. Scotland, you want to be Presbyterian? Go be Presbyterian. And it's sort of this, you know, William of Orange doesn't need everybody to be the same way. He's happy for different people to do what they like, different nations to choose what they want. And so he does that. He says he has England become Episcopalian. He tells Scotland to hold your parliament, decide how you want to have your church, and that's fine. So he's much more kind of tolerant in that way. And skipping forward here. So that's where he's at. And I do want to just, the reason I brought up Daniel Defoe, sorry, I'm going back a little bit, is, you know, so he was sympathetic to the Covenanters and felt like they had a right to fight against King Charles like they did a couple times in some battles. And if you go to quote number 2 there on the back of your outline, I want to read something from Daniel Defoe where he's saying why the Covenanters were justified in their conflicts, especially the Pentland Uprising that occurred in 1666. He said, "We leave all those who afterwards thought it lawful to join in the revolution," so he's talking about to join in bringing William and Mary in as opposed to James, "and in taking up arms against the oppressions and arbitrary government of King James, to judge whether these good men had not the same individual reasons and more for this Pentland expedition. And it is answer enough that those men died for that lawful resisting of arbitrary power which has been justified as legal and acknowledged to be justifiable by the practice and declarations of the respective parliaments of both kingdoms." Okay, so we touched on that last week, but we're saying, you know, the Covenanters are justified in their opposition to the king, King Charles and King James, primarily because now when William and Mary come, all the nation's happy to throw James off and go with William and Mary. And so if they can justify doing that, why can't the Covenanters justify fighting the king all along? But that, anyways, we covered that a little bit last week and just wanted to touch on that. So now we're here. William of Orange has said, okay, Church of Scotland, decide what you want to be. The Parliament meets, and I think in 1689 and 1690 they meet and they decide to be Presbyterian. And they vote to make that the official Church of Scotland, and they ratify at that time the Westminster Confession of Faith. Remember, it was written decades earlier, is now made sort of the constitution of the Church of Scotland in 1690. So they've become Presbyterianism again, but there's some differences from what it used to be. And I'm quoting, this is number 3 on the back page there of your quotes. This is from J.G. Voss. "It will be noted that this act of Parliament restored Presbyterian church government as agreeable to the word. It is one thing to say that Presbyterian is a form of church government that is agreeable to the word of God, and quite another to say that it is the form of church government that is agreeable to the word of God. King William did not believe in the divine right of any particular system of church government, and the Parliament, in settling the government of the church, took the low ground that church government is a matter of expediency or a matter to be decided on the basis of the tradition and preference of the nation since the Reformation. Prelacy was rejected, but not declared to be contrary to Scripture. It is plain that the character of the law was determined by policy rather than by principle. The legislation of the Revolution settlement breathed a different spirit from that of the Second Reformation." Okay, so they're saying this new form of Presbyterianism is different than it used to be because they're saying, well, this is just what we prefer rather than saying this is the biblical form of church government and the only form of church government. And so the Covenanters who are, you know, have not been a part of the official Church of Scotland, been subject to this persecution, they have a decision to make. Do we go back into the Church of Scotland now that it's Presbyterian, or do we continue to be a dissenting body? And if you recall, you know, Donald Cargill had died in 1681. He was the last Covenanter minister. They send 4 young men up to Holland to train them to be ministers, one of whom is James Rennick. Those 4 come back. James Rennick is quickly martyred, and the 3 others actually survive through the persecution, survive to this time. And so those are the 3 ministers of all the Covenanters, and those 3 ministers, along with some Covenanters, choose to go back into the Church of Scotland. And so, but there's a remnant or a group of Covenanters who decide not to go back into the Church of Scotland, and they're once again left without a minister. It's estimated that that group that stayed out was about 10,000 people. That just gives you this, an idea of the size. And this slide here just kind of shows you have the Reformation. England and Scotland are united as Presbyterian, and then under King James and King Charles, or King Charles and King James, England and Scotland are united Episcopalian. When William and Mary come to the scene, now you have Scotland as Presbyterian, England as Episcopalian. And so the Covenanters refused to go out, and you wonder, well, why did they refuse to? And they gave several reasons. They gave four reasons, and I'll read each one of these. So the first reason was that the settlement, this revolution settlement to come up with the Church of Scotland, was what they called Erastian. It was controlled by the government. It was the government telling the church what to do. So the church was Presbyterian, but it was Presbyterian because King William said you could be Presbyterian, because the Parliament said you can be Parliament, you know, as opposed to saying, we, the church, are independent from the nation. We get to decide what we want to be. You have no say in what we are. It wasn't that. It was sort of an allowance given by the government. And so they didn't like that the settlement was Erastian. The second reason was that the covenant, or new Church of Scotland completely neglected the covenants. So you remember, the entire nation of Scotland had signed the National Covenant and then the Solemn League and Covenant. And now, several decades later, you have the Church of Scotland once again established as Presbyterian, and there's no mention of the covenants. It's just like they never happened. And the Covenanters said, you know, we made these covenants with God, and now we're acting as if we never did, and that's wrong. So that was another reason. And then the third reason, which may be the most striking reason, was this settled church, this new Church of Scotland, included many people that had been persecutors. You had elders, you know, people that were elders in the Church of Scotland that had been the soldiers that had gone and persecuted the Covenanters. So now they're elders in this new church. There was no sense of saying, you need to repent for what you did, you need to seek forgiveness, nothing like that. It was as if it hadn't occurred. And so the Covenanters didn't want to go into a church where there was no acknowledgement of the persecution they had suffered and all that thing. So those are the three primary reasons. And they brought those reasons to the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, and the Church of Scotland just sort of ignored them. They would read their grievances. You know, they'd submit a paper with grievances, and they'd read it, but they never addressed it, never did anything. And so the Covenanters felt like, we can't even get a hearing in this church, you know, about what our grievances are. And so they decided to stay out. They decided to dissent and not be a part of this official Church of Scotland, even though it's Presbyterian, but they still have serious concerns about it. And so from 1688, when the new Church of Scotland is formed, until 1707, which is 19 years, the Covenanters have no ministers. They're sort of these praying societies. They realize they don't have any elders, no ministers, no official form of government, but they're not willing to go back into the church. And they do that for 19 years before they finally get their first pastor. So that's sort of the revolution settlement. And I want to cover Covenanters in Scotland up to the present day. And when the Covenanters decide to stay out of the church, they do so in a real strict way. They say the man who kind of led them, his name was Robert Hamilton. He wasn't a minister. He was just a layperson. But he, with others, drafted a document called the Tynwald Paper. And under this paper, the Covenanters refuse any sort of ecclesiastical fellowship with any who did not fully agree with every point espoused in the paper. So they write this several hundred page paper and say, here's all our positions. Here's everything we think. If you can't agree with everything on here, we're not going to have any sort of church fellowship with you. We're never going to have communion with you. We're going to kind of stay totally separate. And I think, for one, I think that might have been a little far, but you can maybe understand the reaction to the persecution they experienced. But they do that, so they kind of say, we're not going to have anything to do with this Church of Scotland. And then the other thing, we're not going to have anything to do with this government, because the government hasn't acknowledged the covenants. It's no better. Sure, it's not persecuting us, but it's no better than King James and King Charles were, because it's still an apostate government. It's refusing to acknowledge the covenants and all of this. And so that's where they're at. They're refusing to be part of the official church. They're refusing to be part of the government. And that meant you couldn't swear an oath of allegiance to the government. You couldn't vote. You couldn't run for office. And you couldn't even pay taxes. But I should say that in England at this time, taxes were based on property ownership and no covenant or own property because of the persecution. And so, you know, no one actually had to pay taxes. So it was sort of a theoretical thing. We won't pay taxes, but none of them had to pay taxes anyway. But that was as far as they took it. We aren't going to do anything that would in any way be viewed as us accepting the legitimacy of this government. We think it's illegitimate. So we're not going to fight against it, but we're not going to vote. We're not going to hold office. We're not going to serve on juries. We're not going to use their courts. We're not going to, you know, do anything that acknowledges that this authority of the government is real. And when I was studying that, I really, you know, that bothered me a little bit, because if you think about Romans 13, Romans 13 is Paul telling the church in Rome, you know, submit to the government because it's the agent of God. God has put that government in place. And you think, who is the government he's talking about? He's talking about the Roman Empire. He's talking about Emperor Nero, who was an incredibly strong persecutor of Christians. And here, you know, Paul is saying he's an agent of God. You know, you need to submit to him. And so you think, how could the Covenanters think about Romans 13 and then, you know, live this way? And they actually addressed that, which is surprising to me. They did. And the way they would say that is, if you, Romans 13 is talking about a government that's in a world and a culture that hasn't seen the light of the gospel. Okay, Christianity is spreading, but the Roman Empire is not thoroughly Christian by any means. It's thoroughly secular or something else. And so their point was, in that scenario, you submit to this pagan government. But in their scenario of Scotland and Great Britain, they're saying, we've had the light of the gospel for centuries. We've had it been a thoroughly Christian nation. And now what's happened is our government has rejected its history, has rejected the covenants, and is in a, it's an apostate government, not a pagan government. And so they would say, because it's apostate, we don't acknowledge it. And so it's sort of a technicality in a way. But I mean, I wanted to stress that, because the Covenanters strongly believed that they were applying the principles of the Bible to how they lived. And so they didn't just ignore Romans 13. They really did address it and felt like we're dealing with the government is illegitimate because it's apostate. If it was simply a pagan government, yeah, Romans 13 would apply, but it doesn't in this scenario. So that's where they were at. Again, a strict separation, strict political dissent, and you'll see that political dissent is what is, you know, for the next several hundred years, that's where our church is, with political dissent, and which is what is its distinctive that makes it different than all the other Presbyterian churches. So this is sort of the first real instance of it, and you'll see that continue for many years. In 1706, you finally have John Macmillan becomes a Covenanter minister. So John Macmillan had been a minister in the Church of Scotland, and he's a pastor of a congregation in the Church of Scotland, and he gets a hold of these old covenants, the National Covenant, and really likes them. And so he kind of leads his congregation in renewing these covenants and saying, let's do this. And that gets him in trouble with his presbytery. They discipline him for doing that. And he leaves over that, begins to interact with the Covenanters, and then they eventually call him to be their minister, and he accepts. And for 37 years, he ministers totally alone. He's the only minister in all of the RP church in Scotland. And he would have been like a circuit riding preacher, itinerant, going from community to community for 37 years, a very lonely ministry. In 1733, something happens which is called the First Secession. And so at this time, the official Church of Scotland, which is Presbyterian, has some serious problems. They were tolerating tolerating ministers in the church that had some bad theology. They weren't that concerned about it. They just sort of let people think what they did. And then the other thing, though, is there were ministers who were very passionate and zealous for the gospel. And really, you know, that was their focus when they preached, declaring people sinful and that they needed a savior and all that kind of stuff. And a couple of them were disciplined by their presbyteries for being too zealous, too passionate for the gospel. And so you see this kind of weird, they were okay with bad theology, but they didn't like it if you were too passionate for the gospel. And then the other thing the church had done is reintroduce patronage. And patronage is where in a community you always have the rich patron, the lord of the land, whoever it is. And oftentimes through taxes, they're sort of the financial support for the church anyways. And so that patron used to be allowed to pick the pastor for that, you know, parish church. And that they had gotten rid of that, and they had, you know, Presbyterian, where the congregation would select it and the presbytery would approve and all that. But now patronage comes back in, and they allow the patron just to simply pick their minister again. And you can see the abuse of that. If you're a patron that has a mistress, you probably aren't going to want a pastor that you hear every week tell you that it's wrong to have a mistress, things like that. So, you can abuse that system. And so, Church of Scotland has some serious problems. And so at this time, there's a group of ministers in it that are fighting against this and decide to finally leave the Church of Scotland. They were led by a man named Ebenezer Erskine. And if you've heard of Erskine College or Erskine Seminary, that's where the name comes from. That's the institutions of the ARP Church, which is the beginning of this church. So he and several other ministers and people leave the church. And they become known as the Associate Presbytery. That's what they call themselves. And their nickname is the Seceders, because they seceded from the church. So that happens in 1733. And you got to think, so the Seceders come out of the Church of Scotland for these reasons. And you can compare, where were the Seceders at doctrinally and in practice? And where were the Covenanters at doctrinally and practice? And if you were to go down, you know, the checklist or go down through everything, they're entirely identical. There's nothing different between them except for political dissent. So they had all the same theology. They had all the same worship practices that, you know, they were exclusive psalmists, a cappella, all that stuff. Everything's identical except for this one thing, political dissent. So the question is, are they going to become, you know, are they going to unite into kind of a dissenting body church, or are they going to stay separate? They stay separate because of that political dissent. It's that big of a deal. And just to give you a sense of how big that was, the RPs had written a testimony in 1761, and it was made up of four parts. There was a historical narration that was 35 pages, then a testimony against the church and state in Scotland that was 37 pages. Then they wrote a testimony against the Seceders that was 46 pages. And then they have kind of this doctrinal statement, which is the shortest part. And so they spend the most pages testifying against the Seceders, against their sort of closest allies, you know, so to speak. And so it's just odd that, you know, it was such a big deal that they would, you know, spend the most of this testimony that's supposed to say, this is who we are as a church, this is what we believe, and we're going to spend the most of our time saying what's wrong with the Seceders. I think that was wrong. Again, I think that was reactionary to their past with the persecution and things like that. It's easy to sit here and judge that, you know, hundreds of years later, but that's where they were at. And the other thing, they, you know, so they write this testimony and they're saying, here's what's wrong with the Church of Scotland, here's what's wrong with the Seceders, here's our, you know, all this stuff. And they would at this point require, if you wanted to just be a member of the church, you had to, you know, read this huge several hundred page document and say, I agree with every single thing in this point by point, I have no disagreement, and I'll be a member. And if you think that, you know, that'd be hard to do anything like evangelizing, right? Like if you have a neighbor you're witnessing to and they become a Christian and they say, hey, I'd like to become a member of your church, and you say, read this, and after you agree with everything, then you can become a member. You know, I think today, you know, it's a lot more about I'm willing to submit to the church and things like that, and not necessarily agree point by point by point. And so anyways, I think a lot of that is, it's easy to judge looking back, but that's where it was in terms of that. This idea of political dissent was a huge issue that kept the Covenanters and the Seceders apart, even though nothing else was different between them. So John Macmillan had become a pastor in 1706. 1743, a man named Thomas Nairn, who was in the Seceders in the Associate Presbytery, he has a falling out with his church and then becomes a minister in the Covenanters. And so now you have John Macmillan and Thomas Nairn, two ministers, two elders. So they're able to form a presbytery. And so in 1743, that's when the official presbytery of the Reformed Presbyterian Church starts in Scotland. And that is the official start of our church, even though it has, you know, lots of history before that. You know, now it's an official church body in 1743. So that you'll see that date sometimes of the kind of the beginning of the Reformed Presbyterian Church. And it started again in Scotland in 1743. Okay? And so at this point, you have, in Scotland, you have three distinct official churches, Presbyterian churches. You have the Official Church of Scotland, which is Presbyterian. You have the Associate Presbyterian, the Seceders, and you have the Covenanters, which is called the Reformed Presbytery. And so you have those three churches in Scotland from then on going forward. There's further divisions in the Church of Scotland and different things, but those are kind of the three main ones going forward. I wanted to mention one man in the Church of Scotland. He was ordained as a minister in 1819, so we're getting more current. His name was William Symington, and he was a minister in Glasgow, Scotland, which is a big kind of industrial town. And he wrote two significant books in his life, in his career. The first one was called The Atonement and Intercession of Christ. So it was about justification, things like that. And the second one was called Messiah the Prince, which is about political dissent, about the mediatorial kingship of Christ. And I think it's interesting the order he wrote those books in. He wrote The Atonement and Intercession of Christ first, and then Messiah the Prince. And so it was almost like he's saying, you know, you have to deal with your own individual relationship with God first. Then you look to how does this affect everything in my life and stuff. So I think it was a good order of that. You know, it didn't assume your relationship with God before you went to everything else, but you dealt with your relationship with God, and then you dealt with your relationship with the world around you. And so this book, Messiah the Prince, though, which is much more well-known than his former book, it's sort of considered sort of the ultimate expression of the mediatorial kingship of Christ. It's sort of the best written thing. He's called the penman of the Covenanters, even though he's, you know, centuries past them. He finally writes this book that sort of espouses what they've been holding to all these years. And I read that book recently, and it's a little hard to read just because it's older. But it is, I think, a good summary of that position of the mediatorial kingship of Christ and political dissent and things like that. So he's sort of known, again, as the penman of the Covenanters because of this book, Messiah the Prince. And you can get copies of that book still today. Like I said, he was a minister in Glasgow, and he had a huge focus on evangelism, on foreign missions, on local missions in the community. You know, at this time, if you think Charles Dickens, there was a lot of child labor going on in Britain. And so Symington didn't start this. Another guy in a different church did, but Symington kind of adopted it. But the idea of a Sabbath school started about this time. So you have these children that are working in factories, and they're working hours upon hours, don't have time to go to school, don't have time to do anything but work. But on Sundays, you know, the factories closed, and so the children were not working. And so the churches said, let's invite these children in on Sundays to come to Sabbath school, and we can teach them to read and teach them to read the Bible. And so it was, you know, a lot. It was partly education. It was partly, you know, witnessing and things like that. And so that is where Sabbath school actually started, was in that scenario of child labor. And so Symington got behind that and really got that going. And Sabbath school, like in a lot of churches, has been a big part of our church as well. If you look back over history, nowadays it's more about Sabbath school is more just sort of, we call it Christian education classes, and it's more for the children and for the, you know, of our own. You know, it's not so much focused about the neighborhood, but it was originally started as sort of an evangelical tool to get these children into the church and teach them to read and things like that. So anyways, William Symington was sort of a bright spot, I think, in the history of the RP Church in Scotland. Did a lot of neat things, and again, sort of wrote this book, Messiah the Prince. That's kind of the epitome in terms of arguing that position of the mediatorial kingship of Christ. Since then, in Scotland, I have in the outline, I call it Decline in Scotland, but a Bright Future. Scotland, from that time forward, becomes increasingly secular. And if you can imagine it, Scotland is more secular than the United States. Today, they estimate that less than 10% of people in Scotland even go to church, you know, whatever that means. I mean, I think it's a smaller percentage that would call themselves Christians and so forth. But so less than 10% of the population in Scotland even go to church. And compare that to the time of the National Covenant, when you had a third of the nation signing the covenant, you had all the nation attending church and things. So there's this tremendous decline in Christianity in general in Scotland, and the Reformed Presbyterian Church was not exempt from that decline. In 1850, The RP Church in Scotland had 46 congregations and about 7,000 members. In 1998, it had 3 congregations and 150 members. So that, I mean, I think you would, if you followed that trend, that would be the same trend for all of Christianity in Scotland, but it's kind of sad to see. But I think the church in Scotland has a bright future. I'd say in the last 15 to 20 years, there's sort of been a turning around. There's now, I think, 6 congregations in Scotland. A couple of those are new works, kind of mission churches. And there's one minister, Andrew Quigley, who's in the congregation of Airdrie that's there, and he's very focused on evangelism and has seen a lot of fruit there. And actually our whole Bible plan reading thing we do as a church is from the Airdrie congregation, from Andrew Quigley. So there's a bright future there. It's exciting now to be there and see, you know, they're focused on church growth, planning churches, evangelism. But for a long time, for 150 years, there was a significant decline. So that's sort of very briefly the church in Scotland up to the present day. Now I want to talk about the church in Northern Ireland. And you can see this is a map of Great Britain. And Ireland is, you know, an island separate from Scotland and England to the west of it. And then on this northern part of Ireland is a place called Northern Ireland. And if you know your IRA history or something like that, you know, there's been a lot of problems between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and things, but what we want to talk about now is this RP Church in Northern Ireland. And you kind of have to go back into history a little bit to understand where Northern Ireland comes from. Why is it separate than regular Ireland? If you go all the way back to King James the First, so the King James of the King James Bible, he's the one, when Elizabeth dies, he comes to the throne of all Great Britain, unites all Ireland, Scotland, and England together under one throne. And obviously some people didn't like that. And in Ireland, in the northern part of Ireland, there were several Gaelic chiefs who didn't like that a lot and actually raised an army to fight against King James. King James raises an army, takes it across the water, and just destroys the Gaelic army. Those several chiefs flee, you know, from the area. And King James, sort of out of revenge, says, I'm going to take all their lands, all their counties, and they're mine. And so he takes this enormous chunk of Ireland in the north and says, this is my land. And he calls it his Ulster Plantation. And his Ulster Plantation is Northern Ireland. It's made up of, I think, 6 or 7 counties or something like that. So it's a big area. And it's just interesting that that's how that came to be. He simply said, that's mine. And took it over. And then what he does is whenever he's, you know, in Scotland or something, when he's having people that he's fighting with, people like Andrew Melville or something, unhappy with him, he'll send them to Northern Ireland. That's where he sends all his, you know, kind of exiles all his opponents there. So what happens is he's sending more and more people that disagree with his policies and stuff to Northern Ireland. And now there's people in Scotland thinking, it's a pretty good place to be. You know, I don't like King James. Why don't I go there? And there's, you know, there's land for the taking and all this stuff. So lots of people start going over there voluntarily, and it becomes sort of the safe haven for Presbyterians, even though it's right north of Ireland, which is a strongly, you know, Catholic country and things. So it's just interesting how that came about to be Northern Ireland. And if you've ever heard the term Scotch-Irish, you know, that, you know, what are you? Oh, I'm Scotch-Irish. I always thought that meant I'm part Scottish, part Irish. It doesn't. It really means I'm a Scottish person or of Scottish heritage, but my ancestors or me moved from Scotland to Northern Ireland first, and then from there we came to America. So we picked up the Irish thing, even though we're not actually Irish. So it's just an interesting thing. Scotch-Irish means a Scottish person that lived in Ireland before they came to America, rather than a, you know, part Scottish, part Irish person. So there's your trivia for the day, because that was pointless. So, anyways, you have lots of Covenanters coming over to Northern Ireland during this time. And Northern Ireland and Ireland is part of Great Britain at this time. And so all the history that's happening in England and Scotland affects Ireland. And so the church in Ireland, the RPC church in Ireland, goes through the same things, not the same sense of persecution that Scotland did. And they continue, though, this practice of political dissent that the Church of Scotland had. They had a sole minister like John Macmillan in Scotland. Their man was William Stadley. He was the only minister in Northern Ireland for a while. And actually in 1798, so think about when 1798 is, that's shortly after the American Revolutionary War, he's ministering then, and he's accused by the government of conspiring with a group called the United Irishmen, which is a precursor to the IRA. And I thought, really? You know, wow, this is getting exciting. You know, but what it was is, you know, here he is, he's leading this group of people in churches and saying, we don't think Great Britain, the British government, is a legitimate authority. We're going to, you know, dissent from voting, dissent from all this stuff, and publicly doing this stuff. And so Britain, who's having to deal with the United Irishmen, sees this guy in Northern Ireland who's sort of, you know, talking like that, and they assume he's been working with the United Irishmen. And so he's accused of that. He's put on trial for it. He is never it's never proven that he did that. He was found not guilty, and I hope he wasn't really a part of that. But it's just interesting that, you know, political dissent can have consequences when the government is afraid of revolts and uprisings and things like that. So that was William Stadley, had some interesting history there. The church in Northern Ireland actually helped start the RP church in Australia. So Australia was a colony of Great Britain at this time, and lots of criminals had been sent there, but other people voluntarily went there for economic opportunity and things. And so, you know, RPs start going that way. And so the RP church in Northern Ireland sends some ministers there and starts a church there. And the church in Australia is still there today. It's pretty small. There's just a few congregations there, but it's its own denomination, the RPC of Australia. So that was a daughter denomination of the Northern Irish church. And the other thing I want to point out about, or two more things I want to point out about Northern Irish RP church. Northern Ireland, so that northern part of Ireland, is about the size of Madera County and Fresno County combined. Okay, so not huge. I mean, Fresno County is a big county, but not that huge. That's the size of it. And in that area, today, there are 37 RP churches and 6,500 members. Okay, so imagine over here in Fresno and Madera County, if we had 36 other RP churches within a 2 or 3 hour drive. That's how it is over there. It's kind of a neat thing. And you can see they're a lot more influential over there than we are in the States, things like that. And one funny story I heard, Wayne Spear, who gave some lectures I used, he was saying he's had friends from Northern Ireland come to America and tell him, hey, we're coming for a week and we'd like to visit, you know, Boston and Orlando and Seattle and Los Angeles, and we have a week to do that. Will that work? And he says, you know, it's just funny. They don't grasp how broad the U.S. is, how large it is, because, you know, they're in a very small area. So it's just interesting there. The other neat thing, the RPC in Northern Ireland has a seminary. It's not an accredited seminary like ours in the U.S. is, and so they call it a theological hall, but it's used to train up the pastors in their church. And it's interesting, they don't have any full-time professors at the seminary. Different pastors from all these different congregations, one day a week, a different pastor will come and teach and then go back. And the whole point behind that is, you know, if you look at seminaries and how quickly they turn liberal theologically and stuff, it's because they're sort of this ivory tower seminary where they're you know, just separate from the regular church, separate from day-to-day activities, whatever it is. And so this is an attempt to say, hey, if you're ministering in your congregations, you know, all, you know, day-to-day, week-to-week, and then from time to time you go and teach at the seminary, there's a lot less risk of going liberal and things like that. And so that's their way to do it. In the U.S., we can't do that because we're more spread out, but we have a similar thing at our seminary where it's an unwritten rule, but almost I think all of our professors are required to have been a pastor before they become a professor. So, again, it's that sense of trying to keep the church and the seminary together as opposed to separating them and then the seminary going off like most American seminaries have, at least the older ones. So anyways, just interesting thing about their seminary there. That's the church in Northern Ireland to the present day. It's very brief in Scotland and Northern Ireland, but hopefully that gives you a taste of them, especially in Northern Ireland with 37 congregations in that small of an area. Now, let's finally get to the NA of RPCNA. Coming to North America. In the 1720s, is when immigration of the Scotch-Irish, again, who are Irish people, Scottish people that lived in Ireland that come to America, that's when the immigration really started, and thousands of them came over, RPs and non-RPs. You know, you have, again, they're all Presbyterian, either mainline, seceder, or covenanter, but all these different types are coming over thousands at a time. And none of them really immigrated from Scotland directly to America. They all went from Scotland to Northern Ireland first and then to America. Why that was, I don't know. Maybe it was easier to leave Scotland for Northern Ireland and then make the decision to go to America or something. But almost everybody came through Northern Ireland on their way to America. One man who lived in Newcastle, Delaware, on the stateside at this time, he said, "It looks as if Ireland is sending all its inhabitants hither. For last week, not less than 6 ships arrived, and every day, 2 or 3 arrive also." So it was just this constant flow of Scotch-Irish immigrants to America. And the Covenanters were part of that immigration, and they came, I think, primarily for 2 reasons. They had trouble in Northern Ireland, just like anywhere in Great Britain. Their marriages and their wills weren't respected by the courts because, you know, they were politically dissenting, things like that. There were still sometimes fines for not attending the parish church. And so there wasn't severe persecution, but there were struggles about just sort of living your life that they had to deal with. And then Northern Ireland at this time was becoming more and more overcrowded, and it was just harder and harder to succeed economically. So for those reasons, they came from Northern Ireland to America, really to seek, you know, freedom and to seek economic opportunity, like most people who came to America. And when they came, they would first go to the large coastal cities, and then he stayed there. At one point, there were 6 RP congregations in New York City, 4 in Boston, 3 in Philadelphia, and 1 in Baltimore. So those are these coastal cities they'd come to. They'd stay there for a while, but people would continue to move on. They'd migrate to upstate New York, South Central Pennsylvania, and to South Carolina. Later, they'd push on to Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, and Colorado, and even later generations would go on to Oregon and Washington and California. And I think the Fresno Church probably started mainly by people from Kansas, RP Church, people from Kansas going from Kansas to California, and kind of a grapes of wrath kind of story there. But so that, you know, and that migration trend east coast to west and farther west is sort of similar to the general American migration, I think, at the time. But so RPs followed that along, and that's how the RP Church spread. It was through migration like that. I did want to talk about one particular minister, John Cuthbertson. So he was born in Scotland. He's ordained in 1747. And the Scottish Church agrees to send him to America to help, because in America you have lots of RPs there now and no ministers. And so the Scottish Church agrees to send this man, John Cuthbertson, there to be a minister to the American RPs. And he arrives in Delaware in 1751. He's 32 years old. And for 23 years, he's the only Covenanter minister in all of America. And that's, you know, so you remember John McMillan in Scotland was the sole minister for a long time. And then Robert Stately in Northern Ireland was the sole minister. So he, no different than them. But Cuthbertson had a lot farther to travel. He would go from, he lived in near Lancaster, Pennsylvania, but he would travel to New Jersey, to New York, to Western Pennsylvania, to Massachusetts. So he's doing all that, and he's doing all of that on horseback. You know, there weren't trains, there weren't cars, there weren't airplanes. So he just sort of lived his life on the back of a horse, going to all these different RP settlements in America. Cuthbertson, he kept a daily journal, so every day he'd write what he was doing, and that survives to this day. And it's sort of a treasure trove to genealogists and things like that, because he kept track of where he went. He'd talk about the adventures he had, about encountering snakes and bears. I think one of the Appalachian Mountains is called Blue Mountain, and one night he was lost on the side of Blue Mountain and recounts that story. One night he's staying with out in the boonies with an RP family, and he sleeps in a bed there, and he writes in his journal real short, he says, "Slept none, bugs." So, you know, that doesn't sound, I appreciated that. I hate bugs, so. But you can imagine that he's a pretty rough guy, and for him not to be able to sleep because of bugs, it must have been pretty bad. it's estimated during his ministry he baptized more than 1,000 RP babies, and he's the only one who can do it, so it's not surprising, but it's just amazing, you know, that he would go around. That was part of it. He baptized babies, or you know, sometimes probably children by the time he got around to them. And he, you know, in his journal, he'd recount all of those baptisms and their names and dates and things like that. And that's part of the reason the genealogists really like his stuff. But it was, as you can imagine, very tough ministry. And in his diary, the most common phrase he has is, he writes it in Latin. He says, "Festus, Festus Valde." Does anyone know what that means in Latin? It means tired, very tired. Okay, so he wrote that over and over. He was a tired man. Festus Valde, or Festus, Festus Valde. So I assume Festus means tired and Valde means very. But so anyways, just an interesting man there. Several times he tries to form a presbytery. He writes letters to Scotland and Northern Ireland and says, send more ministers here, you know, so we can form presbyteries and establish churches and things. But Scotland, Northern Ireland, you know, are limited on their own ministers, and so they're kind of, you know, they're not always wanting to leave. But they finally do send over 3 at one point. One of those ministers dies soon, and the other 2, surprisingly, were thrown out for drunkenness. And I thought, drunkenness? You know, where did that come from? And it's interesting that these 2 ministers went down to South Carolina. And again, they're itinerant ministers. They're going around from area to area, and especially in the South, you know, when the minister came to your town, you had them over in your home, you know, you showed them hospitality. And so instead of giving them water, you get out the good stuff, and you give them scotch or whiskey. And you know, these ministers would make 5 or 6 visits in a day, and each home is providing the same level of hospitality. And, you know, it turned into a problem, and so they were thrown out for drunkenness. And later, when we talk about our church's interaction with prohibition and alcohol and those things, this will come into play. You can see this, you know, this was frustrating to them. But anyway, so that 1 dies, 2 are thrown out for drunkenness, and it's back to Cuthbertson alone. But finally, in 1774, 2 more ministers are sent over, and they kind of stick. And so they, with Cuthbertson, are able to form a presbytery of Covenanters in America. But that's short-lived. And if you think 1774, what's happening in America at this time? Anything big? All right, the American Revolution, right? And so the Covenanters, who can't stand Great Britain, are happy to be a part of the Revolution, happy to throw off, you know, fight against the king and get rid of this sort of apostate government, right, and start afresh in America with a new Christian government. So they're happy to fight in the Revolutionary War, and they do. But now, you know, then, and we'll get into this next week, but what happens is, you know, America wins the Revolutionary War, starts its new government, and now the question is, do we continue political dissent? We weren't willing to be a part of the Great Britain and their government and acknowledge their legitimacy. Can we do that with the American government? And we'll get into that huge kind of question next week. But what ends up happening is Cuthbertson and these 2 other ministers think they should give it up. And so they join with the Associate Presbyterian Church, with the seceders, and form what becomes called the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. And that happened in 1782. And then there's a small group of Covenanters that stay out, and we'll get into their reasons, and stay as, you know, Covenanters, as RPs, aren't willing to be part of that merger and continue on from there. It's not until 1798 that they can then form a presbytery. And so 1798 is sort of the official start of the RP church in America. But again, there's a lot of history before that, a lot of presence before that. They'll eventually break into 3 presbyteries because they get big enough, and they cleverly name them the Northern, the Middle, and the Southern Presbyteries. Not very creative. So next week we'll look into that. Why, you know, for one, there's a lot of neat history about Covenanters in the Revolutionary War, and then there's also neat history about Covenanters in the U.S. Constitution and the forming of the American government, and why they continue to dissent. So that's what we'll cover next week.